Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We have had some problems in airing some of our shows, and we kind of understood that. I was hoping we could get everyone played. We had 2 whole weeks laid out, boom, 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 boom. And so it seems like, at least the last few days, South Carolina did not get aired because we had some reruns of previous shows of some of the other debates that were going through, either amendments or what have you, the small, short debates. So what we're going to do is we're going to lean into Pennsylvania, and then we're going to re-air South Carolina. And the reason we're going to re-air it, because only getting one of the 3 days that we recorded is just insufficient, so that you can understand the paradigm in one of the very few states that made such focus on slavery and their need and dependence of slavery. Again, you won't find any of this kind of dialogue in Virginia, North Carolina, Massachusetts, or the rest of them, other than, you know, maybe up in Massachusetts, how, you know, they want to see it, you know, be ridden of. And so anyway, we believe that this content is important. We know that in addition to defining the Constitution, they are providing us a portal of how, you know, what was the ground truth at the time? Where was slavery really in America? And you can tell, slavery was on its way out. They did everything they could to abolish slavery during the Constitutional Convention. And this becomes evident in the South Carolina debates. So this way you can understand that because of 3 states out of 13, I mean, shoot, is that even 1/4? No, that's not even 25%. But because the few claimed that they had to have this or they would leave the Union, the rest made a huge, insurmountable, incalculable, you know, travesty in allowing a political compromise to move forward. I'll say this time and time again. Had the northern states, had Virginia and the rest of the states, told the 2 Carolinas and Georgia, good, you're on your own. We're not going to have anything to do with you. And when Spain, south of Georgia, decides to harass you and come to subjugate you under the crown of Spain, who, by the way, were real bastards. I mean, they did not treat... I mean, look at how they ravaged Mexico and South. They were not sympathetic or empathetic conquerors. I would say this, that as much as people complained about Europe and the European conquests and so forth, every nation in the world was engaging in conquest. Even the Native American nations were engaging in small miniature conquests, taking the land from their competitors, because that's what a primal society does. As we were developing, we actually developed laws. And one of the few states were the northern states of Europe that actually abided by those laws and treated the indigenous people and treated, you know, those inhabitants with some moral justice, whether we, you know, thought it was great or not. However we felt, the paradigms were different then. And as a matter of fact, we did everything we could to try to create an accord and try to create a harmony. And as a matter of fact, we did a really good job up until Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson decimated what I could consider the good work of Washington and Jefferson and so forth. in developing a strong relationship with the Native Americans. So anyway, I digress. The fact of the matter is, what we should have done was allowed, again, those three states that wanted to be on their own, because it would have only been a matter of time when either France, Britain, and or Spain would decide to march and or, you know, divide and conquer, and they would be quickly coming to us to help them. And why would that be? Because they would have been easily exploited. Oh, well, how? Because the majority of the laborers, the majority of those who, you know, exerted force and energy were their slaves. And it would only take a smart conquering force to come in and free the slaves and empower them to basically kill their masters and just take over. This was easily discussed throughout. It was even mentioned in the ratification debates that there is this huge vulnerability of allowing slavery to exist. Anyway, we would have been able to get rid of it had they not made that compromise. We would have been able, our problems today would be completely different. Not that we wouldn't have these idiots like Black Lives Matter. Not that we wouldn't have these exploiters like Obama and Biden and Sharpton and all the rest of these exploiters of the grievance industry in trying to get people all keyed up over very specific things. So anyway, what we want to do is we want to get into the Pennsylvania ratification debates. As you know, the show is sponsored by republicreview.org, and you are listening to the only show that goes through the academic evidence and academic evidence-based solutions. So once we're done with the Pennsylvania debates, then we'll play the South Carolina debates again, and then we'll move forward into the Massachusetts debates, and then probably the North Carolina debates, possibly either the New York debates first or the New York debates last. I typically do those last because there's just a lot of theory, and there's some meat in there, but it's just not as good, just due to the fact that Hamilton had to mind his P's and Q's because he was under oath. And a lawyer under oath is very, very clear not to expose too much information. So you didn't find really huge revelations or him going out on limbs like he did with the Federalist Papers, because he knew he wasn't under oath then. And he could have made all sorts of snide remarks and promises and so forth. But anyway, what we want to do is we want to remind you that, that we do have a comment line, 425-270-5416. And so if you've got a question or comment, which we actually just had somebody call us last week, and so we do actually reach back to you as soon as possible. I mean, it may not be within the hour, but we do try to get back as soon as we possibly can. And so if you've got a comment, you got a question, 425-270-5416. And so with that, let's get into, well, I'm not going to say it's my least favorite debates, but I will tell you this, that when I look at the Philadelphia debates, I don't find the banter back and forth. It's just not present. All we're really getting is the Federalists who are answering questions, and we don't even know what those questions are. Sometimes they tell us where they're coming from, but it's just not the same. And so I really wish we would have better clarity as to the Pennsylvania ratification debates regarding, you know, how it was really debated instead of these orations in answering so forth and so on. So anyway, the first comment, and this is by Mr. Wilson, and Mr. Wilson is the primary speaker. Mr. McKean will speak a little bit later, but what we're going to go through are highlights that come out of Mr. Wilson's orations, and these are long orations, and, you know, I guess he was, I guess, Pennsylvania's Patrick Henry, because Patrick Henry was probably one of the most prowess and most fascinating and most captivating orator of Virginia of the time. As a matter of fact, people were just scared to death whenever he got up there, not just because of, you know, what he could say, but just the amount of time that he could suck out of the room. Anyway, so this is what he talks about regarding delegated power. Before the revolution, many of the kings claimed to reign by divine right, and others by hereditary right. And even at the revolution, nothing further was effected or attempted than the recognition of certain parts of original contract, Blackstone 233, supposed at some former remote period to have been made between the king and the people. A contract seems to exclude rather than imply delegated power. The judges of Great Britain are appointed by the crown. The judicial authority, therefore, does not depend upon representation. Even in its most remote degree, does representation prevail in the legislative department of the British government. Even here, it does not predominate, though it may serve as a check. The legislature consists of three branches: the king, the lords, and the commons. Of these, only the latter are supposed by the Constitution to represent the authority of the people. And we'll leave it at that, and we'll come right back with more orations from Mr. Wilson. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so he goes on and says, after he just made this comment regarding the Constitution and the British Crown and so forth, this short analysis clearly shows to what a narrow corner of the British Constitution the principle of representation is confined. I believe it does not extend farther, if so far, in any other government in Europe. For the American states were reserved the glory and the happiness of diffusing this vital principle throughout the constituent parts of government. Representation is the chain of communication between the people and those to whom they have committed the exercise of the powers of government.
This chain must consist of one or more links, but in all cases, it should be sufficiently strong and discernible to be left without guide or precedent, which was not only difficult, in which the convention were involved by proposing to their constituents a plan of a Confederate Republic, they found themselves embarrassed with another of peculiar delicacy and importance. I mean that of drawing a proper line between the national government and the governments of the several states. It was easy to discover a proper and satisfactory principle on the subject. Whatever object of government is confined in its operation and effects within the bounds of a particular state would be considered as belonging to the government of that state. Whatever object of the government extends to its operation or effects beyond the bounds of a particular state should be considered as belonging to the government of the United States. But though this principle be sound and satisfactory, its application to particular cases would be accompanied with much difficulty, because in its application, room must be allowed for great discretionary latitude of construction of the principle. In order to lessen or remove the difficulty arising from discretionary construction on this subject, an enumeration of particular instances which the application of the principle ought to take place. What he just said was an enumeration of particular instances or delegations of powers in which the application of the principle ought to take place, has been attempted with much industry and care. It is only in mathematical science that a line can be described with mathematical precision. But I flatter myself that upon the strictest investigation, the enumeration will be found safe and unexceptionable and accurate to in as great a degree as an accuracy can be expected in a subject of this nature. Particulars under this head will be more properly explained when we descend to the minute view of the enumeration which is made in the proposed Constitution. And so he goes on and on and on and on. And this is, and I'm going to actually jump down, because this is really very good oration. This is really good insights as he's trying to explain to everybody the foregoing powers and principles and conclusions and everything else. And so starting on the next day, he's talking about enumerations. And he says, "I cannot say, Mr. President, what were the reasons of every member of that convention for not adding a Bill of Rights. I believe the truth is that as such an idea never entered the mind of many of them, I do not recollect to have heard the subject mentioned till within about 3 days of the time of our rising, towards the end of the convention. Then there was no direct motion offered for anything of the kind. I may be mistaken in this, but as far as my memory serves me, I believe it was the case. A proposition to adopt a measure that would have supposed that we were to throwing into a general government every power not expressly reserved by the people would have been spurned at in the House with the greatest indignation. Even in a single government, if the powers of the people rest on the same establishment as is expressed in this Constitution, a Bill of Rights is by no means a necessary measure. In a government possessed of enumerated powers, such as a measure would not be only unnecessary, but preposterous and dangerous. Whence comes this notion that in the United States there is no security without a Bill of Rights? Have the citizens of South Carolina no security for their liberties? They have no Bill of Rights. Are the citizens of the eastern side of Delaware less free or less secured in their liberties than those on the west side? The state of New Jersey has no Bill of Rights. The state of New York has no Bill of Rights. The states of Connecticut and Rhode Island have no Bill of Rights. I know not whether I have exactly enumerated the states who have not thought it necessary to add a Bill of Rights to their constitutions, But this enumeration, sir, will serve to show by experience as well as principle that even in a single government, a Bill of Rights is not an essential or necessary measure. But in a government consisting of enumerated powers, such as proposed for the United States, a Bill of Rights would not only be unnecessary, but in my humble judgment, highly imprudent. In all societies, there are many powers and rights which cannot be particularly enumerated. A Bill of Rights annexed to a Constitution is an enumeration of powers reserved. If we attempt an enumeration, everything that has not enumerated is presumed to be given. The consequence is that an imperfect enumeration would throw all implied power into the scale of government, and the rights of the people would be rendered incomplete. On the other hand, an imperfect enumeration of the powers of the government reserve all implied powers to the people, and that means that the Constitution becomes incomplete, but of the two, it is much safer to run the risk on the side of the Constitution, for an omission in the enumeration of powers of government is neither so dangerous nor important as an omission in the enumeration of the rights of the people. Do you get it? Do you understand? This big argument going back and forth between the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, and why they created a Constitution without a Bill of Rights, and actually they base the Constitution upon enumerated powers. Now, when they injected the Bill of Rights, some people would go, oh, well, that became a swinging of the door where all powers were then granted except for these. No. There was no verbiage, there was no wording in any of the amendments to the Bill of Rights that all powers are now granted. What they did was they used very specific wording to ensure that the Constitution had enumerated powers, and then more declaratory, nugatory powers were placed upon very specific things, such as religion, the freedom of the press, the freedom of search and seizure, and those types of things, to ensure that the federal government could not encroach upon these specific rights down the road. Now, one would say, well, you know, hey, why do that? Well, if you think, down the road, somebody could easily have granted the federal government an amendment. Let's say, granted them an amendment to make whiskey and hard liquor illegal for production, consumption, and possession. Let's just say an amendment like that was created and we didn't have a Bill of Rights. Well, if you didn't have a Bill of Rights that created these protections from illegal search and seizure and those types of things, then they would have had the conscription of and the formula for a very tyrannical government, being able to just come in because that right was not reserved and they had received a general authority or this general power to be able to cease and control, because the federal government would be the ones that were supposed to enforce this. Now, technically, when the federal government is to enforce a law, who has the power within the Constitution to execute it? The militia, period. The federal government cannot create an ATF. They cannot create an agency. They have to call forth a militia to execute the laws of the Union. That is very specific in Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15. Anyway, let's move on. Necessary and proper. The gentleman in opposition strongly insists that the general clause at the end of the 8th section gives to Congress a power of legislating generally. I cannot conceive by what means he will render the words susceptible of that expansion. Can the words, quote, the Congress shall have the power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper to carry into execution the foregoing powers, be capable of giving them general legislative powers? I hope that is not meant to give Congress merely an elusive show of authority to deceive themselves or constituents any longer. On the contrary, I trust it is meant that they shall have the power of carrying into effect the laws which they shall make under the powers vested in them by this Constitution. In answer to the gentleman from Fayette, Mr. Smiley, on the subject of the press, I beg leave to make an observation. It is very true, sir, that this Constitution says nothing regard to that subject, nor was it necessary, because it will not be found there. There is given to the general government no power whatsoever concerning, and no law in pursuance of the Constitution can possibly be enacted to destroy that liberty of the press, period. So here he's, you know, he's already weaving back and forth and knocking these things out of the park, as far as I'm concerned, because he's already explained the enumerated powers and the limitations in this Constitution. We'll be right back after these two promos.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADD-LOCAL or visit them on the web at www.addlocal.com. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so let's move down in some oration. And actually, this is like a couple of days later. The last thing we actually read was on December. It was Saturday, December 1st. And now we're on Tuesday, December 4th. Mr. Wilson starts his next long oration, and we're going to get into enumerated powers. And he goes as he states quite like this: is it a maxim in forming governments that not all the powers which are given, but also that all those which are reserved should be enumerated? I apprehend that the powers given and reserved from the whole rights of the people as men and as citizens, I consider that there are very few who understand the whole of these rights. All the political writers from Grotius to Pufendorf down to Vattel have treated on this subject, but in no one of these books, nor in the aggregate of them all, can you find a complete enumeration of rights appertaining to the people as men and citizens. There are two kinds of government: that where general power is intended to be given to the legislature, and that where the powers are particularly enumerated. In the last case, the implied result is that nothing more is intended to be given than what has so enumerated, unless it results from the nature of the government itself. On the other hand, when general legislative powers are given, then the people part with their authority, and on the gentleman's principle of government retaining nothing but in government, like the proposed one, there can be no necessity for a Bill of Rights, for on my principle, the people never part with their power. Now let me expound upon one thing, because he talks about, he says that nothing be given what is so enumerated unless it results from the nature of the government itself. And I'll give you a good example of something that basically results from the nature of government itself. There was nowhere in the Constitution to create a general accounting office. However, because the government had to procure furniture, it had to build buildings, it had to basically create property, it had to have a mechanism of accounting and controlling and understanding what its assets and liabilities and those types of things were. And so it was the nature of government itself that required the General Accounting Office. Even though that may not have been an enumerated power, it was a necessary and proper power to assist in the execution of the foregoing powers. For them to build a building, they needed to be able to create those types of contracts and so forth. So just to be clear, there was no implication in the Constitution. It was a nature of government itself that it needed to do that one thing. Now, when it comes down to energy and dictating what energy is to be used and how, you know, energy is to be processed and treated for car consumptions and trucks and so forth, there is no enumerated power, nor has there any implication in the nature of government for them to have any zero controls or any powers over energy. Those powers are reserved to the people and to the states. Do you understand? Good. Anyway, then he goes on and he continues in stating this. This is Mr. Wilson. It would be worthwhile, Mr. President, to consider this objection at large. When I had the honor of speaking formally on the subject, I stated in a concise a manner as possible the leading ideas that occurred to me to ascertain where this supreme and sovereign power resides. It has not been, nor I presume will it be denied, that somewhere there is and of necessity must be supreme and absolute and uncontrollable authority. This, I believe, may justly be termed the sovereign power, for from that government, Mr. Finley's account of the matter, it cannot be sovereign unless it is supreme. For, says he, a subordinate sovereignty is no sovereignty at all. I had the honor of observing that if the question was asked where the supreme power resided, different answers would be given by different writers. I mentioned that Blackstone will tell you that in Britain it is lodged in the British Parliament, and I believe there is no writer on the subject on the other side of the Atlantic but supposed it was vested in that body. I stated further that if the question was asked to some politician who had not considered the subject with sufficient accuracy where the supreme power resided in our governments, he would answer that it was vested in the state constitutions. This opinion approaches near truth, but it does not reach it. For the truth is that the supreme, absolute, and uncontrollable authority remains with the people. I mentioned also that the practical recognition of this truth was reserved for the honor of this country. I recollect no constitution founded on this principle, but we have witnessed the improvement and enjoy the happiness of seeing it carried into practice, that the great and penetrating mind of Locke seems to be the only one that pointed towards even the theory of this great truth. There you go. And so he now kind of jumps into representation. Down the road here, he continues orating, and then now this is what he says regarding representation. I say, sir, that it was the design of the system to take some power from the state governments and place it in the general government. It was also the design that the people should be admitted to the exercise of some powers, which they did not exercise under the present federation. It was thought proper that the citizens as well as the states should be represented how far the representation in the Senate is representation of the states. We shall see by and by when we come to consider the branch of the federal government. And then he goes on and on and on, and then he talks about jurisdiction. Do we wish a return of those insurrections and tumults to which a sister state was lately exposed? Now we're talking about Massachusetts. Or a government of such insufficiency as the present one to be found, the Articles of Confederation. Let me, sir, mention one circumstance in the recollection of every honorable gentleman who hears me. To the detriment, to the determination of Congress are submitted all disputes between the states concerning the boundary, jurisdiction, or right of soil. In consequence of this power, after much altercation, expense, and time, the considerable expense of money, this state was successful enough to obtain a degree or a decree in her favor in a difference with subsisting between her and Connecticut. But what was the consequence? The Congress had no power to carry the decree into execution. And so, therefore, they didn't have that jurisdiction within the Articles of Confederation. They were basically, they just wasted their time. However, in this new Constitution, that jurisdiction is clear. Now, moving into the concept of commerce, Mr. Wilson states this: no man is obliged to consume more than he pleases, and each buys in proportion only to his consumption. The price of the commodity is blended with the tax, and the person is often not sensible of the payment. Would it have been proper to rest the matter there? Suppose this fund should not prove sufficient. Ought the public debts to remain unpaid, or the exigencies of government be left unprovided for? Should our tranquility be exposed to the assaults of the foreign enemies, or violence among ourselves because the objects of commerce may not furnish a sufficient revenue to secure them all? Certainly, Congress would possess the power of raising revenue from their constituents for the purposes mentioned in the 8th section of the first article, which is, quote, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. It has been common with the gentlemen on this subject to present us with frightful pictures. We are told of the host of tax gatherers that will swarm through the land. And whenever taxes are mentioned, military force seems to be the attending idea. I think I may venture to predict that the taxes of the general government, if any shall be laid, will be more equitable and less expensive than those impositioned by the several state governments. Well, yeah, as long as they're spending the money or using money to carry out the enumerated powers. When the federal government is no longer in check of the powers it executes and can spend money and tax money on things it has no jurisdiction and no power to do, they become limitless, unlimited in being able to create debt and to basically, and all of this is fraudulent. I have told you this before. The federal government is operating a house of cards in executing powers that they do not possess. Now, here's a little snippet on the Necessary and Proper Clause. It is urged as a general objection to the system that, quote, the powers of Congress are unlimited and undefined, and that they will be the judges in all cases of what is necessary and proper for them to do, close quote. To bring this subject to your view, I need do more than point to the words in the Constitution, beginning in the 8th section, Article 1. And then he's going to actually quote that and then read on regarding the foregoing powers. And so this is the Necessary and Proper Clause. So we'll be right back after these two promos on this Necessary and Proper Clause. Thank you so much.
To
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so he kind of just pointed to the eighth section of the first article, and then he quotes this. The Congress, it says, shall have power, quote, and etc. And I need not read over the words, but I leave it to every gentleman to say whether the powers are not so accurately and minutely defined as can be well done on the same subject, in the same language. The old Constitution is as strongly marked on this subject, and even the concluding clause with which so much fault has been found gives no more or other powers, nor does it in any degree go beyond the particular enumeration. For when it is said that Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper, those words are limited and denned by the following, quote, for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, close quote. It is saying no more than that the powers we have already particularly given shall be effectually carried into execution. Pretty clear, huh? Yeah. This is the consistency amongst every state as they've defined the Constitution. Why is it that we do not recognize these hardcore definitions? Because they don't want us to know how well-defined the Constitution really was. I'm just telling you, these framers, these men were brilliant. The divine hand of providence knew that there would be the necessity of documenting these contractual understandings, that in these last days, these understandings will come forth to refute the perversion of this government that we're being despotically ruled over. This is regarding commerce. Mr. Wilson states, the letter which accompanies this Constitution must strike every person with the utmost force. Quote, the friends of our country have long seen and desired that the power of war, peace, and treaties, that of levying money and regulating commerce, and the responding executive and judicial authorities should be fully and effectually vested in the general government of the Union. But the impropriety of delegating such extensive trust into one body of men is evident, hence results the necessity of a different organization. And so he goes on and then kind of talks about this. And the interesting thing is that what they actually did was they created such a unique organization never to have existed, where we had an executive, a separate judiciary, as well as a separate legislative branch, three co-equals. Anyway, so Mr. Wilson, then we skip down to December 7th, and this is when Mr. Wilson starts talking a little bit about treaties, jurisdiction, commerce, and so forth. And so regarding treaties, the judicial power extends to all cases arising under treaties made or which shall be made by the United States. I shall not repeat at this time what has been said with regard to the power of the states to make treaties. It cannot be controverted that when made, they ought to be observed, but it is highly improper that this regulation should be made, for the truth is, and I am sorry to say it, that in order to prevent the payment of the British debts and from other causes, our treaties have been violated, and violated too by the express laws of the several states in the Union. Pennsylvania, to honor or to her honor be it spoken, has hitherto done no act of this kind, but it is acknowledged on all sides that many states in the Union have infringed the treaty, and it is well known that when the Minister of the United States made a demand of Lord Carmarthen of a surrender of the Western Post, he told the minister with the truth and justice, quote, "The treaty under which you claim those possessions has not been performed on your part, and until that is done, those possessions will not be delivered up. This clause, sir, will show that the world that we make the faith of treaties a constitutional part of the character of the United States, that we secure its performance no longer nominally for the judges of the United States, will we be enabled to carry into effect, let the legislatures of the different states do what they may." Now, I'm here to tell you, when it comes to treaties, if the general government does not have the authority in the Constitution to subject, so there is no authority in our Constitution to submit the United States as a member of a new form of government under the United Nations. That doesn't exist. Now, we do have the ability to create treaties for trade. We have the ability to create treaties for debt and those types of things, but not to join another government. That is not an enumerated power. And so when we joined the United Nations, that was a violation, because that was power not delegated by the states to allow the federal government to even go down this path. I want to be very clear on this, because there are lots of problems that are coming out of these treaties with the United Nations, such as the honoring of refugees, the honoring of asylums, and those types of things. And I'm here to tell you that those are not delegated powers, and this is how our Constitution is being subverted by unconstitutionally formed treaties. These men just said, okay, well, because we are the government, we can do whatever we want. No. No, we give you these delegated powers, and these are the only things you have keys to execute. You cannot drive that car because we've never delegated that car or truck to you, but you can drive these roller skates. You can fly this kite. You can do this and you can do that, because these are the delegated powers. But if it is not delegated within the Constitution, you cannot create a treaty for this. And as a matter of fact, this is very clear in the Virginia ratification debate. So we will get to that. Anyway, Mr. Wilson goes on and talks about jurisdiction. Quote, "Between citizens of different states and between a state or the citizens thereof and foreign states, citizens or subjects, this part of jurisdiction, I presume, will occasion more doubt than any other part, and at your first view, it may seem exposed to objections well-founded of great weight. But I apprehend that this be the case only at first glance. Permit me to observe here, with the regard to this power or any other of the foregoing powers given to the federal court, that they are not exclusively given. In all instances, the party may commence suits in the courts of the several states. Even the United States may submit to such decision if they think proper, though the citizens of a state and the citizens of subjects of foreign states may sue in the federal court, it does not follow that they must sue. These are the instances in which the jurisdiction of the United States may be exercised, and we have all the reason in the world to believe that it will be exercised impartially, for it would be improper to infer that judges would abandon their duty, the rather for being independent. Such a sentiment is contrary to the experience and ought not to be hazarded. If the people of the United States are fairly represented and the President and the Senate are wise enough to choose men of abilities and integrity for judges, there can be no apprehension because, as I mentioned before, the government can have no interest in injuring the citizens. Now, some people would probably argue otherwise with that, but moving into commerce. Suppose a war was suddenly declared against us by a foreign power. Let's say the Ottoman Empire possessed a formidable navy. Our navigation would be laid prostrate. Our imposts must cease. And shall our extensions as a nation depend upon the peaceful navigation of our seas? A strong exertion of maritime power on the part of an enemy might deprive us of the sources of revenue in a very few months. It may suit honorable gentlemen who live in the western extremity of this state that they should contribute nothing by internal taxes to the support of the general government. They care not what restraints are laid upon our commerce, for what is the commerce of Philadelphia to the inhabitants on the other side of the Allegheny Mountains? But though it may suit them, it does not suit those in the lower part of the states, who are by far more numerous, nor can we agree that our safety should depend upon a revenue arising from commerce. And so this is why excises may be necessary mode of taxation. It places its most states already. And it basically, he's just pointing out that the primary form of revenue would be from commerce, but the ability of capitation taxes as well as excise taxes and so forth would be necessary so that the federal government can come up with the necessary funding to deal with the exigencies of government for national security and so forth. Anyway, so what we want to do is we're going to cover one more comment. Let me see, do I have time? No, I do not have time. So we are going to come back, and this is where Mr. Wilson is going to be talking about the supreme law of the land and so forth. And so there's lots more that we will be covering in our next episode regarding the Pennsylvania debates. And we will re-air the South Carolina debates after this. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.